This is Catherine McNamara. She's the publisher of Archipelago Press Publishers. Sorry, Archipelago Publishers and Artist Proof Editions, which has just released its first title on iTunes for download onto the iPad, right? And as an artist's book. She was the founding editor and publisher of the web journal Archipelago from 1997 to 2007. And she is the author of Narrow Road to the Deep North, A Journey into the Interior of Alaska, a nonfiction narrative. She's going to be talking to Cliff tonight about his new book. Clifford Garsing is a former attorney and now a full-time writer, and he teaches writing. And he has his first collection called In an Uncharted Country, and his new novel and stories with the Zhang Boys now. And he is a Writer House member, and he is a resident of Stanton, Virginia.
Why don't we begin with Cliff's reading from the book?
Thank you. I'm just going to read two pages from the very first story of the book because it really gives you a flavor for what the setting is and also who all of the main characters are. It's a novel in stories, so each of the stories is independent and stands alone. And this first story is called Nanking Mansion, which is also the name of the building that all these people live in. How did it happen that every person Zhang Fengqi knows in America is in the same place at the same time? Clustered at one end of the wide, high-ceilinged hallway, known to the building's residents as the gallery for its large, abstract canvases, there they all stand. Fengqi's father, newly arrived from China, who only a month ago struggled to fill the meaningless days of his Shanghai widowerhood. Fengqi's two sons, with their hybrid features, hazel eyes, pale yellow skin, and hair that is almost, but not quite, black. His dour, gray-suited mother-in-law, or, more precisely, the mother of his late wife, Maddie, who, Fengqi suspects, also hovers nearby, amused by the chaos she knows makes his knees tremble. And in the background, his pasty, mustachioed neighbors, the two men who live together in the next apartment and might be homosexuals, but since Fengqi does not know how such men behave and thus has no basis for comparison, he can't be certain. Another neighbor, from the far end of the gallery, a reclusive painter, the creator of one of the hallway abstracts, with spatters of paint on his jeans and bare feet. The skeletal, wild-haired sculptor from apartment number 3, who always works, or so it seems to Fengqi, who has observed the man work on a few occasions, and invariably it was the same, with a smoldering cigarette clutched between his yellowed teeth, ash raining on his unfathomable creations of twisted timber and clay. The young, blank-eyed couple, constantly hand-holding or arm-locked, entwined as if each draws energy from the other's touch. And the fat Armenian, the developer who resurrected this building, the Nanking Mansion, a 1920s tenement on the racially tense edge of D.C.'s Chinatown, converted into overpriced artists' lofts, in which Fengqi and his family had somehow, Fengqi no longer remembers how or why, except that it was his wife's idea for them to mingle with artsy people, as if their own lives of mathematics and public policy were too uncreative an environment in which to raise their sons. Come to live amidst a flock of flamboyant painters and sculptors and writers. Even Fengqi's boss is there, a Labor Department bureaucrat who has stopped by with work for Fengqi, an accordion file with Frank boldly scrawled on the side. Fengqi's co-workers in the Bureau of Statistics call him Frank, uniformly unable or unwilling to bend their throats around the unfamiliar vowel and consonant combinations, and vaguely uncertain, even after all the time he's toiled among them, whether Zhang or Fengqi is his given name, knowing or thinking they know that Chinese names are the inverse of American names. Containing a statistical comparison of unemployment in 4 urban markets, which the secretary needs immediately before Monday if possible, even though Fengqi has taken these few days of his annual leave to help his father get better settled after an initially rocky start to his life in America. No, not quite everyone he knows. Jessica Lee, the Chinese woman from Olson's books on Fifth Street, who even before Maddie's accident had caught his eye, not in any illicit or unsavory way, but by virtue of her being Chinese, that's all it had been at first. Jessica Lee isn't there. She is, though, due at any minute. Feng Qi looks at his watch.
I read this book without reading anything about the author. And as I read, I noted with pleased surprise that his sensibility seemed to me, I don't want to say not quite American, but American in the of the sort, the sensibility which has been formed by more than one culture. It was not to me certainly a sentimental Hollywood kind of unfolding in this book. And so I progressed. But now I come back to my first question, which will perhaps make sense to you having heard the first pages. And it is this: how did you know that these people, Feng Qi and his sons, and his father, were Chinese?
So can I ask you a question back?
Wait. Let me alter my question. Not how did you know these people, but how did you know these characters were Chinese?
Well, I'm going to answer the question that I think I heard,
yes.
Which is that I wanted to write about characters who were Chinese because I had been traveling to China a lot when I was writing the book. And in particular, because I should back up. Actually, I had already decided on the setting before I decided on the characters, because I was myself living near Chinatown in D.C. And so that seemed to be a promising setting for the book. But then I was traveling a lot to China, and I had recently been in Shanghai and Nanjing. And I was in Nanjing on a day when they were commemorating the Nanjing massacre. It was a very moving experience to hear the sirens blare and the whole city come to a standstill, and to go out to the part of the city where the memorial is built. And so that was in my mind when I started working on the book. Mm-hmm. And then the third part of that is I had read an essay by Sven Burkertz, if anybody here has taken my class, you may have heard me talk about this essay. It's called On Traction. And in the essay, he describes how he immediately dismisses works of fiction in the first sentence or paragraph by discovering that the character is too familiar. And he does that with the language that the author uses, but also the name of the character. So I decided, okay, Sven, I've got a Chinese name for you.
See you in Raise Your Five.
Yeah. And so I wrote the story, and I sent it to that magazine, and it got rejected. But anyway, I challenged him.
Well, I liked it because, again, I thought there is no cliche here. This author is not necessarily writing what he knows, which is the dreary thing that apparently is enjoined upon young writers, but something else, it seemed to me, that you had... It's too simple to say written what you didn't know, because I don't think that's the case. But we talked about this a little bit before. Maybe you'd talk about, you know, discourse on that.
Well, certainly every writing class that I took up to a few years ago used the write what you know thing. And it sounded like it makes sense, right? Because you do have to be convincing on the page, and you have to provide credible details and put the reader in place and all of that. But I was very fortunate to have a workshop with Grace Paley several years ago. And one of the first things she said in this workshop is that it's not write what you know. It's write what you don't know about what you know. And she was saying that it's important to, you've got a starting point, but you've really got to push yourself beyond that starting point. And related, other teachers have said similar things to me about letting the imagination really build on what you know, so that you're not spending too much time in the very familiar. So I love writing about things that are not too familiar. And yet, this isn't a building that I used to live in. So I'm comfortable with this setting, and I've spent a lot of time in China, so I'm comfortable with that culture and language. So I think that's important, too.
Mm-hmm. I recognize these characters, and I'll keep saying that, as what you know, as they presented themselves. That is to say, they were, I don't want to say authentic, it wasn't that convincing, right? But what also interested me was this undertaking of making a novel of short stories, which is not undone, after all. I mean, you could start with Boccaccio if you want. But it has an interesting characteristic here, I think. And I think this is somewhat similarly so in your first book. It seems to me that what you do is you take a group of characters, and they are characters, and you don't they're not novelistic in the sense that there's not psychological development, which some of us find pleasing, actually. They're not types either, but they are, and they're not quite telegraphed, but there's a way. The way I think of it is they're treated respectfully in that you don't pry into their being. What you do is let them display certain actions. And it seems to me also that what all of them have in common in various ways is that what sets off the action, if that's what to call it, is that each of them comes to a kind of abyss. There's a grief that each of them is almost blindsided by, and they suddenly enter a whole uncharted territory of emotion that they had not known before, but they don't have any time to sit and think about this. They have to live and they have to care for other people. And so what happens is you have this group of characters with certain characteristics, but you also have other elements that you have in there. For example, even in your first book, there's some little Chinese element, right? Or there's the color of an eye, or there is the color of an eye. And there is a work of art in some way, a writer, a sculptor, a painter, all of whom are doing work that is wholly engrossing, but not first rate. And so, you know, there's this, what you seem to do is a kind of, not quite a kaleidoscope, but almost like a cat's cradle. You take these characters and these elements, and then from story to story, you shift the strings. And you know, then another part of the whole story that they're all part of becomes revealed. Does that sound like what you thought you did?
I love that description. So yes. I will grab onto your comment about the abyss, because that that part at least, I knew what I was doing. Because I did know that we all suffer loss, and one of the things that I knew would tie these characters together is that there is a loss in each case, and that even though it's quite a diverse community, all these people I described and a few more who live in this building, they do have that in common, and of course we all have that in common, and so it's maybe magnified here. I guess you use the word kaleidoscope, which is, it is all jumbled in that way, but it's magnified.
But it's not jumbled. This is the thing, and this is what's also very pleasing about it. It's not jumbled. It's reconfigured. Mm. If you don't mind my making that distinction, because you're very precise. Yes, you're very precise. I mean, you are very lawyer-like, I think. And you're, no, because there is a logic to this, which is not a plot, but it's a logic.
Reply to that.
Right. Anyway, sorry.
We started out talking really about what the novel and stories is, and we, since we've mentioned the first book, I didn't think of that as a novel in stories because I didn't think of it as a book when I started writing the stories. I wrote a story and another story and another story, and they grew, they entwined really because there were characters that I wanted to explore further. So I would write a whole story about that character who had been a minor character in the first story. And there were issues that were unresolved in some of the stories that I wanted to push a little further. And so then after a couple of years of doing that, I had this big pile of stories. And naturally, we all want to publish books. So I put this pile of stories into a book. And it seemed to pull together pretty nicely, especially when I added one more story to wrap it up. But when I started writing this book, I designed it from the beginning as a novel that would tell one big story with themes that tied the stories together. And I intentionally made the setting much smaller so that it would that the totality would be more cohesive, even more cohesive than the linked story collection. And I wrote the passage that I read to you, I wrote first. And in fact, it was longer because I had all of the characters in the book originally were in that passage, including names. Mm. So it was almost an outline of what the book was going to be. And so I knew exactly who these people were when I started writing all the rest of the stories. And I think that made it more of a novel for me as I was doing it than the first book.
I was thinking about what made this a novel. In the Germans have what they call Literatur Wissenschaft. We don't have the equivalent in Anglo-American literature. And in fact, German scholars think Anglo-American literature has the novel and the short story, and the nature of the short story is it's shorter than a novel. So here we are, I don't want to say making it up as we go along, but because that's not true either, quite, but something like that. But it struck me that whatever a novel is, and I don't know. Do you know?
Well, no, I don't know. But because I teach, I have to pretend that I know. And so, I mean, the definition that I use when I'm trying to distinguish among novel, novella, short story, and flash fiction is that, the novel is... Yes, it is, really. Mm. The novel is the wide-angle lens that can cover all space and time. And the shorter the piece is, the less room you have to delve into the entire universe, the entire history of characters, and events. So a short story really is more like a microscope, really, where you, and I violate this all the time, but where you're supposed to focus on a shorter period of time, a smaller number of characters. And there was a great essay in the Poets and Writers this month by Ben Percy, where he's advising his students to forget about backstory. You don't need backstory. And most of the time that's true.
But then you have to convey a lot precisely.
You have to convey a lot precisely. And I end up with more backstory than Ben Percy would necessarily like. But but anyway, it's more focused than a novel. So I use the camera metaphor to get at those different pieces.
It's said that, you know, story is now, I think, more of a cliche in sort of public discourse. Everybody has a story and so on and so on. That may or may not be the case, but I wonder, in terms of making the art of the story, how did you know when your stories were finished? But I mean, the distinction, and I think there is one, and I think it's profound, and it's given, it exists before us, the difference between a story and an anecdote, let's say. It occurred to me, thinking about this, as, I mean, these are not chapters. And what's the difference between a story and a chapter, let's say? I don't have an answer, but I was thinking about it, and perhaps you'd like to, to discourse. But somewhere in there, I think there's a notion, or there's a question too about anecdote and the distinction between, and I think there is one, between an anecdote and a story.
Well, there absolutely is. I think that a story has to have conflict. An anecdote doesn't necessarily have conflict. And conflict is a result of causation. Causation is a result of desire. And so I don't necessarily know exactly what a character wants when I start writing a story, but I do eventually. And often I will begin just with a character and a situation and write. And I'll get to a point where I realize what I want to be writing about, what I want the themes of a story to be, and then I start over again. And then I have to ask myself, what is it that's at stake in this story for this character? In an anecdote, I don't think I ever care. You may never even discover that there's anything at stake. It's just a little slice of life, and it's a description of something that happens, but isn't necessarily something that is imbued with conflict. And really, to make a story, I'm going to use the word suspenseful, even though I don't write suspense, but
right.
to make a story compelling, you do have to have conflict on some level. And you get that by figuring out what it is that what your character wants.
Mm-hmm.
That naturally comes to a climax at some point, because there's a resolution of the forces that are at work here, what the character wants and whatever is in opposition to the character. That comes to a head. And then you don't have much time after that to finish up. So that's how I get to the ending.
Can I propose, and perhaps, well, surely you know this long before I did, what I finally thought, I don't think books are about anything, but let's say there's a central theme. I thought it might be, and there's a chapter title of this, called The Nations of Witness. One of the most, it's not elusive, but one of the most tricky characters, you could say, and he's a not tricky, but trickster characters, is the writer who suddenly flies in from Paris and gets caught up in other themes like the replacement wife and the Chinese beauty and so on, which is also another theme, isn't it, from your earlier book. In any case, and he's writing a book that he calls Nations of Witness, because he has encountered people who have lost horribly all through Europe and so on. I've forgotten now the specifics, but it seemed to me that, and even as you're a little bit, not quite mocking about him, but he's a little more full of himself than perhaps his audience might be. But his desire is noble. And that is what I think it is. And I think perhaps that is the theme even of this book about these, these, in a way, small people who are living in this refurbished but not luxurious and not perhaps well-built building in a dicey area. Who are going along and somehow living.
For a while, The Nations of Witness was the title of the book. So there's some credence to your theory. that's a fairly grandiose ambition that I had, if that's what the book was about. And so the book is about that, but on a more domestic level, it's not about that. And so I backed away from that. But I have to say that if I have a favorite character in the book, it's Nathan. So.
It seems so. Although the title itself is also awfully good, because what the Zhang boys know is, I suppose, what we all have to know, that we'll have to go through life and they have to know that they'll have to find their way without their mother. And I wonder if that isn't, again, an opening for you to something else.
Well,
I mean, that's a huge thing by itself.
Yeah,
that wasn't a spoiler, by the way.
Right, she dies before the book starts, so... for one thing, the boys tie the stories together more than, the themes tie the stories all together, and all these characters live in the same building, but the boys appear in all of the stories, and they discover little bits about all of the residents. So on one level, what the Zhang boys know is what's going on in all of the apartments. But as Catherine said, there's more. They're discovering what life is about, really, in the search for their mother and the understanding of what has happened to her, to their mother. So yeah, it does open things up.
Right. There, and again, there's no sentimentality here. I mean, there's huge loss. These people somehow set themselves going. It's can you say more about that? They don't dwell on their sorrows, or they do for a while and things happen and they have to do something else, but there is no discussion of it. They don't talk over their troubles.
Yeah, and that's I think that's reflective of my personality. It's very, if you've read this week's, it's actually next week's New Yorker, the fiction next week is a story called Literally by Antonia Nelson. I almost felt like she'd read my book before she wrote that story, because it's about a father and son, and before the story starts, the mother has been killed in an automobile accident. And there's a lot more emotion that is expressed by those characters, especially the father. I mean, there is crying. I don't write crying.
But the emotion. This is. Can I just put an addition here? What moved me quite a lot was in the first story. Here is this man whose wife is wiped out in an accident. You can feel grief, but it is not imposed upon you, and he doesn't present it to you. So you've done a remarkable and I think sometimes difficult thing, which is you're not imposing on the reader. What you're doing is allowing, by description, the emotion to come up, and the reader then can respond as she or he sees fit.
Well, I'm glad you had that reaction. Certainly, you can spend a lot of time telling readers how to feel and insulting readers in that way. Or you can be somewhat melodramatic and have the characters react in an overtly emotional way, and that's also kind of insulting to readers. So I was aiming for something in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. What haven't I asked that I should have asked? Or that you would have liked me to ask? Or that you would like to comment on?
Well, I guess one of the other... you did mention the art a little bit. And
right.
It was very important to me to write about creativity as part of this. And in the passage that I read, Feng Chi says that he doesn't really know why they were in this building, except that his wife thought it would be good for them to mingle with the artsy folk. Mm-hmm. And I felt the same way, that I thought it would be good for him to mingle with more creative types, and for the boys to see people like that. And so the building is really an arts community with this central gallery. And I'll just mention as an aside, I was down at VCCA residency the past couple of weeks, and one of the... I was describing my book and the building, and she said, "I know that building," one of the visual artists. And it turned out she did know the building. She knew my neighbors, my old neighbors in this building, and she was familiar with the wide hallway that was our art gallery. But I also wanted to use the paintings themselves as part of the one of the, especially one of the stories, but they also feature in a couple of the other stories because that's another doorway to understanding what the particular characters are about. Not only the fellow who created this one painting in particular, but then what other people see in the painting. And then that the idea of the abstract painting that sort of shifts in interpretation depending on who's looking at it is what led me to the cover that my publisher found, this beautiful abstract painting that suggests different things to different people. So the art is really important to me. And there's another art piece too. The sculptor has a statue that's very meaningful to him, but means something completely different to his son in that story. So.
You convey art as solace, I think. Art making as solace. I think that's the word. It's certainly not anything like therapy, because nothing like that comes near this book. But some of the characters turn that way and are able to go out of themselves in a way that that's very moving. It's very moving because it's not proposed that they're making great art. It's not proposed that they're making lesser art either. That's not the point. It's that they enter the process of making and something, and we know what that's like, something else then happens to them. And we're allowed to witness that, witness to some degree, and then infer. It's very, very nice.
Well, thank you for all those great questions.
shall we open it?
So I have a question. Is it mainly that you just really like writing short stories, or that you didn't want to do something that was chapter, 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 one big story, that you like the mosaic of writing shorter? Is that just your temperament, you think, or was there something else?
It's either my temperament or my talent. I had, before I wrote the stories in my first book, I had finished my MFA thesis, which was a very long novel. And so writing those short stories was a relief. And when I had finished that book, I tried to go back and fix everything I got wrong in my novel, and I was just really sick of it. So I turned back to short stories. But to be honest, for marketability purposes, I conceived of this. You know, as Catherine said, I didn't exactly invent the genre of the novel and stories, but it sounded to me like something that I could persuade agents and publishers to take on. So I thought I was pulling the wool over somebody's eyes by writing the kinds of things that I liked to do, but in a form that looked like something else. Turns
well,
out
to
I
push
didn't
that, and you brought that up. Why are they short stories rather than chapters? Is it because there's no transition that you would get from a chapter? But what is the difference between?
Well, in a novel, a chapter ought to have the same kind of arc that a short story does, and the same kind of not a complete resolution, but some kind of a resolution at the end of the chapter, and at the same time. Providing the momentum to
so
move
that's
on
a transition,
to the next.
Right. Isn't it?
A transition or just a hook.
So is that the difference?
It's a difference.
It's a difference, yeah.
The other thing is you don't have suspense. And somehow in a novel, isn't there implied suspense?
Right. So
just as you don't have melodrama.
The hook from one chapter to another, the suspense that carries the reader forward, mm-hmm. isn't there with independent stories necessarily.
But isn't that the whole purpose of your first chapter is to set up the suspense of the book? In other words, we're going to follow Feng Shui and see how he copes with the fact that his wife is gone and he's got these boys to raise. So each story, in a way, is moving that premise forward. I mean, I thought that
but it doesn't move it forward. Maybe that's a difference. I mean, that's what starts. It moves it out and around and back in.
It goes out and comes back in again from a different angle. Mm-hmm. So rather, it's definitely not linear. Gotcha. So I think
you can do that in a novel too.
You can do that in a novel. One can do that in a novel.
Yes.
But when you're reading the stories, I mean, when I was reading the stories, I wanted to. I was interested, especially in the link to the boys. And the father. That's what I was following.
So you were
each
looking...
story. I mean, I liked that the other characters had issues and dealt with their lives and that everybody's lives were moving, and they were living. I liked all that, but it still wasn't the kind of short story collection, even like your first short story collection, which you could put down and go off and do something else. I mean, it was the book I was reading, and when I got through one day, I wanted to read the next chapter the next day. I mean, I wanted to see what happened with that family.
Good.
So it
Thank
had
you.
That. Well, my question is, did you change your mind about where to put the chapter from the boys' point of view? Did that move?
That was pretty much always right in the middle.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think.
Because from a novelist's point of view, I wondered if you'd put it later and then... Moved it back.
I don't think so. I think it was there. I did move a couple of things around because of the chronology of things that happened in the stories, mm-hmm. Just for logic. But the Zhang family story is the backbone of the book, and so that kind of had to be in the middle. Just like the shrine to his ancestors has to be at the end. And so you've got the Nanking Mansion story, the Zhang Boy story, and the shrine story forming the backbone. In my mind, it was always in the middle.
I'd like to ask you about four authors and see if they have any effect on your writing, Cliff. to follow from Sally's question, probably the best, or at least the best known Chinese-American writer is Amy Tom. Mm-hmm. And her first chapter of The Joy Luck Club sits up literally every other book she's ever written, and of course sits up The Joy Luck Club brilliantly, and maybe the best first chapter in American literature. Okay. She also follows very closely Faulkner's comment that the problem with the past is it isn't even past. Okay, all that backstory coming forward. Did she have any effect on your writing?
Well, I read a lot of Amy Tan a long time ago, so it would be very indirect if it had any effect, because it was such a long time ago, long before I began writing.
Okay, what about, say, Ken Kesey in Sometimes a Great Notion, where the first 40 pages are talking about the river? That's the same kind of art in the gallery, the sense of place, however it is defined. Does that have any effect?
Well, that's interesting. For a long time, that was my favorite book. I loved that book. But again, I haven't thought about it in decades.
Okay.
That doesn't mean it's not down there.
That's interesting.
Sherman Alexie, who writes Native American literature from the basis of a novel and short stories.
Mm-hmm.
Timberland Indians, Smoke Signals, Tonto, and Lone Ranger Fistfight in Heaven, I think is the title of those. All of those are, each of the chapters is an individual story in itself, and yet they all move like a novel. Like
he's a lot funnier than I am.
He is hilarious. Part of it has to do with what you're talking about. Not the first sentence has to be unfamiliar enough for the reader, so they bring it forward. Do you have any effect on your writing?
Well, again, my reading of him is more recent than of the others that you've mentioned, but not the structure of the book, I don't think I've read a whole book of his. I've read only individual stories. But I've read a number. I even teach his stories sometimes in workshops. So.
Well, then one final one more. is Robert Parker. Many of his characters come back. Rita Fiore shows up in Sonny Randall books, shows up in Spencer books, shows up in Jesse Stone books, and they all move in and out of books and stories, and yet he has virtually no backstory, and it's all backstory at the same time, which sounds, I haven't read, unfortunately, it sounds like Kathleen's description of yours. If he has any effect on it.
No, I haven't read any Robert Parker, but that concept is not unique to Parker, and I have talked about one of the beauties of the novel and stories concept is that you are building, by writing one story, you've created the backstory for the next story. And so if you, even with a linked story collection, I've already created the environment that the next story is in by describing the building or describing the town. So I don't have to repeat myself all the time. So you do have it's like a novel in that sense, because you're only creating the world once, and you're expanding on it in every story, and so the world gets more vivid as you go
and you
through
recombine it.
And you things change and shift around, and you see things differently than you might have because of the changing perspectives, which is maybe one other thing that we could talk about, the fact that all of these stories are from different, well, except the first and the last, are from different points of view.
Right, and you're standing in different parts of the building.
And the, right, so I cover all the units, almost all the units, and get all the people, and it's very unusual for a novel to take on that kind of a shifting view, even so. But that's part of the fun of doing short stories, right? And even if you're trying to put them together in a novel, by having these very different people and then inhabiting their minds for 20 pages or so is a lot of fun, which is, I enjoyed that in my first book too, even though that's not quite as closely linked. So, Salts, I'm sorry I disappointed you.
No, that's okay. I was just wondering.
What about David Schickler's Kissing in Manhattan? Because it's an apartment building also.
Right.
I
didn't know about that until after I had written the book. And, of course, one of my blurbers, I guess it's Catherine Weber, who's not on the book, but she makes the comparison to Kissing in Manhattan. But there, you know, I could go through a whole list of novels and stories that, you know, they all take place in a bar or
Grand Hotel,
you know, and we all know about Winesburg, Ohio, which is really maybe the model for all of us who write novels and stories. It certainly was an influence on Elizabeth Strout's Olive Kittredge. Other questions?
So when you started, you knew it was a novel, is that right?
Yes.
And so you moved forward from the first story, the second story, and then sometimes you switched around a little bit.
Yes. Yeah, I had after I had written this first story, which I then started submitting to magazines, I just made a list of all the characters and said I'm going to write a story about each one, and I think I wrote them in the order of this list that I made, which was kind of random. And then I did have to shift them a little bit because of the chronology of events. But with this this list was my outline, and it was. I think what I did, I had a list of all of their names and their occupations, and then I made some notations about what I thought in a crisis in their life might be, and I just sort of winged it from there.
I was thinking, that grief was the thing they all had in common, but I think there's another, if you want, not an inverse, because it's also in grief, but the other thing you have in there is beauty. That is to say, not just beauty of effect, but beauty as a principle, isn't it? Certainly in your first book, in that wonderful fairy tale. It's my favorite story, I think, in the first book. It's so graceful and terrifying. And it's this, not even a conflict, I don't think. It's they're inside out of each other. But beauty and grief are so closely, and I think now that's the other half of your motif. As I think back on it,
I like that, and I think that it's I can't say that
but
was.
I mean, quite literally. I mean, there is a character in the first book called character called Beauty, and then her earthly avatar called Belle, who is not quite. But then the same appears here in the replacement wife, you could say.
Mm.
In a more mundane way, but also not. The beautiful Chinese woman, the wife, and then the second Chinese, Nathan's replacements, when in fact it was supposed to be Zhang's replacement, and so on. So there's a lot more play also. You're letting yourself play more.
That must be deep-seated something.
Well, we're not doing psychology.
Right. Thank you. Thank you.